This is another Australian Baby Boomer podcast.
Welcome to another episode of the Australian Baby Boomer podcast. Today's guest is Trevor, another naturally gifted storyteller. As a teenager, Trevor, like many young men of the late 60s and early 70s, was conscripted into the military, potentially to serve in the Vietnam War. Compulsory national service was reintroduced in Australia in 1964, and in May 1965, the coalition government introduced new powers that enabled it to send national servicemen to serve overseas. From 1965 to 1972, 15,381 national servicemen served in the Vietnam War, with 200 killed and 1,279 wounded. Trevor's name came up in the ballot, but the timing was fortunate, as when Prime Minister Gough Whitlam came to power, he ended conscription, and Trevor was able to leave to return to his trade in the building industry. Subsequently, he went on to work building houses in remote communities and is still a registered builder who takes an interest in how the regulations and implementation of regulations has changed over time. Thank you for listening.
Well, I'm Trevor. I'm just the average person, I think, in my opinion. Anyway, I started life at Melville High School and then went on and did an apprenticeship with the government as a carpenter and joiner with the Public Works Department. I finished that really early. I was probably about 19 at the time, a little bit over 19, and I went straight up north and worked for numerous companies, working at building base camps for mining, Coolin Island, Cockatoo, all those sort of places.
Wow. So are you retired now, are you?
I'm retired now, I'm fully retired now. Straight after that, I did time in the Army as a national serviceman, and I got out of the Army just as Gough got elected, so... When Gough Whitlam got in, that was it. I didn't particularly... I was a sapper in engineers, and there wasn't a lot to do in the Army, and I'd worked all my life as a contractor prior to the apprenticeship.
Were you conscripted? Did you come up in the ballot?
Yeah, I was conscripted, in the ballot, yeah. So I got out when Gough got in. I only did probably 18 months at the time. And then he gave you the option at that point to leave immediately, because he'd got rid of national service, or you could... finish your time, and I think it was 2 years. It wasn't long, only about another 6 months. And then they'd give you a cheap housing loan. But I was
paid
off with the Army by then. I wanted to get out.
Because
Vietnam, they'd stopped sending people to Vietnam. So nothing to do. You're basically, you know, people don't realise how boring life in the Army can be, you know, like this. They've got all that we had everything, equipment. We could build roads, bridges, but you couldn't do anything. They had no money to do anything.
So. Oh, okay. So
and you weren't allowed to compete with private enterprise, so everyone just sat around and played cards. And got bored. We actually built the major that was a Rotary Club member, and they were building a disabled kids camp just out of Seymour. I was in Pakapanyo. He said to all of his guys, if you want to go and work on this disabled kids camp, I'll let you save up your leave, because in the Army you had to take your leave. And we were from WA to get home. You know, you had to. So for every weekend we worked, he'd give us the 2 days in the leave so we could save up enough to come home again. So we built this camp. You know, there was a couple of brickies and me and an electrician and a plumber. And that was common. If you had all this equipment and it was sitting around doing nothing. But we used to do that up north. You know, people would ask you to do things and you do them.
Did you enjoy the early part of the Army, or was it...
The 3 months, the first bit of training.
Yeah.
That was fine, you know, because you're doing something every day. And then you did 3 months of core training after that, like as an engineer, on explosives and all that sort of stuff. And that was interesting because you're doing something every day. But then once you got posted after that...
It got boring.
Depending where you went, it could be okay or not. And where I was, they just literally had nothing to do. Or we used to do all the explosive demonstrations for Skyville, which was the... Skyville was the officer training school for Nashos. So they had Duntroon for the regulars and Skyville for the Nashos. So, because a lot of the Nashos became second lieutenants or whatever and stayed in the Army after that.
Yeah.
So we used to do all of the demonstrations. Then they had to learn about each corps, a little bit about every corps, so they're supposed to know a little bit about everything. And we used to do all of that. So that was interesting, but that was only like 3 days a month we had to do that, you know. So that was an easy, set all their stuff up, blow everything up and then put it all away and then do it again the next. But you only did about 3 weeks' work, hard work in a month, you know. Mm. And I've been used to working hard. And the money was terrible, you know. Like when we were up north, it was the beginning of, because there was nothing up there, so it was all pretty rough and ready. And you got paid really good money. And I was probably earning nearly $200 a day way back then, you know. And I went from that to the army, where I was earning about $40 a week.
Right, yeah, so...
So, you know,
so
there's a huge difference.
Yeah, that's a big difference,
I don't think it was even $40. I can't remember. It was a really small amount. And of that, they kept some of it to pay for some of your stuff, you know.
Yeah.
Your boot polish and your whatever else you have to use.
Yeah, that's an interesting thing, the conscription, isn't it? Because a lot of people would have lost out on their...
Yeah.
On, you know, financially be conscripted into the army.
Yeah, it was... Well, it cost me a fortune, you know, because we were just getting into it up there at that point. And then you've got to sort of start again because you have that break and then you come back and then you think, oh, well, I'll go back there or...
Yeah.
Luckily for me, I'd met this guy in the army who was another carpenter and we decided, well, we'll have a crack at subbing together, and that's where we started for that. And when we got out, we... started working together as contractors again, as subbies, in those days they used to call us, for the guy that had run our industries. He by then had started his own business. He went broke and left some contracts unfinished. One of them was for the Catholic Church at Del Wallonia. So we took over building those and started a company that's still around today. Well, he'd approached us and said, look, I've failed, I'm going broke. He was an ex-priest, actually. He's quite an unusual guy. And he said, you know, would you like to finish those contracts? Like, he went broke in as much as he didn't owe a lot of money, but he couldn't complete the contracts. He'd run out of credit. So, we'd finished those, and then from that, we got other work. We found quickly that if you do a reasonable job in the bush, people, you don't have to advertise much, you just keep... And we did a lot of work all around Killarney and out the back of Goodlands and Lake Moore and places like that.
Word of mouth.
Sort of word of mouth. And then we got bigger and bigger. My uncle had a poultry farm in Gosnells that he'd just got out of, and that was going to become urban, obviously, opposite the golf course in Alcock Street. And he lent us the land for about a year, and we started the business. In those days, you didn't have to get shire approval. You just basically did whatever you wanted to do.
Started a business.
Well, I mean, you couldn't do it today, but, so we started a business there, and then eventually ran into an old guy called Arthur, and Arthur was a real character. Arthur had land everywhere, and we couldn't get any money from the bank. The bank wouldn't loan us any money, and Arthur said, I'll stand you for the money on vendor's terms, but if you miss two payments, I'll take it back. So he's pretty ruthless.
Mm.
But, he taught me a lot about business, old Arthur. He'd been in prison for selling dead wool. I'd never even heard of that before.
Dead wool?
Yeah, apparently that was a prisonable offence in the old days.
Oh, okay. What's that?
They used to pay people to go around, like when sheep had died, and they'd pull the wool off, put it in bags, and then salt the real wool. So you'd buy, say, 20 bales of real wool, and you might have 10 bales of dead wool, and you'd mix it up and put it in. Apparently the dead wool's no good. And he got caught, and apparently he went inside for it, so he was a real character.
I suppose you would have met a few characters. You were saying before that you got some contracts for some of the remote communities.
Yes, we did.
And so how did that come about?
We met a guy called McLeod. I don't know if you remember McLeod. He was a guy that ran the Nookumbar strike. Remember the strike at Nookumbar when they tried to drill for oil on native land?
Yeah.
Well, McLeod was a stockman who ran that strike, and he started a company called Nomads Limited. And Nomads Limited, he was a real character, another real character. He never wore shoes in his life.
Right.
So he used to come into an office meeting in Perth and he'd have bare feet.
Right, okay.
So he's a real character. And he started at Strelley Station, the old Strelley Station. They purchased that, or they got hold of that. I'm not quite sure whether there was a lot of government money in it, but it was some private, obviously, backing as well. And we did about four jobs for them on Strelley. And Strelley then was the largest continuously, in one straight line, owned piece of land in the world.
Right,
It went from Strelley Station up to the Northern Territory border, basically. Typical Tanami Desert, that sort of country, you know, which is terrific country, I think, but a lot of people would probably disagree with me. It gets very, very hot and And of course, even today, there's not a lot up there.
The red dirt and the kind dirt, of
those undulating sand dunes that go on forever. And
yeah.
Yeah, all around there. And then from that, we then met other contacts with other Aboriginal communities. We started at Warburton.
Okay.
And then we then did another job at Cosmo Newbury. Then we went up to Giles and did a job at Giles. And then Belgo, we got some work at Belgo. And then we started winning a few government contracts at that point.
Okay.
We got a bit of a name by then. And we did a lot of... We didn't just do transportable homes, we did kits as well.
Right.
So we used to do a lot of prefabricated stuff where you couldn't get transportable homes into communities, though, to the roads were no good. You know,
right.
Or there was just tracks.
So what was there before the transportable homes?
The community was always there, or a lot in most cases. Often, like Belgo, there was a lot of Catholic missions.
Okay.
Like Belgo was a Catholic mission.
Yeah.
Beagle Bay was a Catholic mission. We did work at Beagle Bay. Columbaroo was a Catholic mission. So that, and then as the church pulled back, the community took over. Some of them were quite good. Like some of them, they'd built quite a bit of infrastructure. The churches there. There's always a church. Schools, quite often, quite a bit of housing. And it was in that in-between period when the Aboriginal communities were taking over themselves and the churches were basically pulling back. So there's quite a bit of government money around at the time to give them infrastructure. But there'd always been something there, which is basically a more modernising of what they had.
Yes,
like,
yeah.
We did a lot of work at One Arm Point. And at One Arm Point, they had a lot of their own infrastructure, but they didn't want houses or anything like that. They sort of liked how they were living and they didn't want to change it.
Traditional way of life.
So they used to cook outside and do other things. So it was sort of, we built some structures there, but they weren't anything like houses, if you know what I mean.
Right, yeah.
And that was just how they wanted to live. And
yep.
In those days, sure it's the same today. They could pretty much do what they liked on their own land. But yeah, we did a lot of work all around there and on stations, Cambellan and places like that.
Was there a thing where people could renovate or do maintenance on houses?
Oh, it's an ongoing thing, yeah.
Ongoing thing,
and in a lot of cases, we didn't get really heavily involved in that. We did on occasions. We had to do our own maintenance, like in the maintenance period. But after the home had been built or transported there or whatever it was, that was pretty much up to them then. And in a lot of cases, they then went on and did all their own maintenance work and stuff like that.
Right.
Or got someone from Derby or wherever the nearest town was to come out and do it.
Yeah.
Or the government often was involved in it, you know.
Right.
They often had training going. I'm not so sure whether they do it as much today, but they often had a lot of training stuff going on within them.
Yeah.
We did a couple of jobs where they were built on site, like as a kit home, and we trained locals in conjunction with government trainers, you know, to try and get them involved in building and doing their own stuff.
I guess that'd be kind of an eye-opener to you for culture and different way of life and all of that.
Well, because I've been up there since I was about 19, when I first went up there, I worked at Whitnoo.
Okay.
And building a base camp for Hamersley Exploration. And the guy that was in charge of the job got hurt. And there was only about five of us there and the rest were all contractors. So they said to me, oh, well, you'll have to look after the job, so... I then employed a heap of TIs, the Thursday Islanders, who were working up there on the railway lines as railway gangers.
Right.
And these guys were pretty rough sort of characters. And they were on the loose, so we employed them and we ran a batching plant. We had to do a lot of concrete work. Mm-hmm. So I'd always worked with Aboriginal people from the time I was 19, pretty much all the way through.
So that's in a big responsibility at 19 to be...
It was, I didn't really want to do it, but they said, oh, well... And then it wasn't long after that I got caught up in the army. So I finished that job and then did the one on Coolman and started one on Cockatoo. And then that's when I had to leave to go in the army. So in those days, there was people were very free and easy. So all the regulation we have today, there was none of that.
Right.
And I remember when I first employed these Thursday Island guys, they met me in the pub up there, I can't remember the name of the pub now, the Fortescue Hotel in Whitnoo. And they said they were looking for work. And I said, well, I've got a batching plant. We need to get started. And they said, oh, yeah, we've done batching before. We know how to run a plant. Anyway, so I employed them. And then immediately the cop came and saw me and he said, you've employed those guys? I said, yeah. He said, those boys are pretty rough. And I said, yeah, but they'll be all right, you know. He said, well, I'm telling you now, any damage done around town, you have to... I'm looking for you, not for them. He said, I've done all this before. So that's how it used to work. It was a real eye-opener for me at that point. because I'd never sort of experienced that before. Those cops said to me, oh, any damage, I'll be looking for you, not them.
So what's batching?
Concrete, making concrete. Yeah, oh, okay. Yeah. You basically just got an automatic skip. It was all done manually.
Yeah.
So you shovel everything into a skip, and then the skip goes up a rail and tips into a big mixer, and then you add your water and then pour it back out into a machine and then transport it around the site to wherever you want it.
Okay. So were you like a project manager too? You basically had to bring in people for different parts of the job and that sort of thing.
Well, in those days, they didn't call you project manager, but that's probably about the equivalent today.
Yes.
Well, I had to make sure there were transportable buildings were brought up. You had to get them set up, connected to sewerage power, and then do all the footpaths, verandas and all that sort of stuff.
Do all the organisation.
Yeah, all that sort of stuff.
Yeah.
And then hand the camp over at the end.
Yeah.
When it was finished, you know.
Yeah. So how long did you do that for?
I was probably only there for about 3.5 months because it was half done when I got there.
Yeah.
It only took us about 3.5 months to finish it because they're all transportable buildings.
Okay.
And then at that time there was a big cyclone went through and did a lot of damage on the coast, on Cockatoo and Coolin. And houses they'd built there previously had their roofs ripped off. So we had to go over and sort all that out. You know?
Right.
So that camp wasn't quite finished, but it was near enough.
So we left
that and went over there.
Oh, okay. And the houses you were doing, did you have to start adjusting for cyclone conditions and things like that?
Yeah, well, they already had cyclonic conditions in those days,
yeah.
Like as far as part of the building code.
Yeah.
But, you know, it was never as policed as it is today. Today, like after that, when we got back to Perth, we started our own... When I eventually started to ride, we started our own steel frame business as well because of the cyclonic problems.
Mm.
And we designed a home from the bottom up, so that was totally cyclonic for it. So when that... I can't remember the name of it. Remember the big one that went through Exmouth and did all the damage there and they put an army guy in charge of Exmouth for about a year? You couldn't get into the town and... was just a disaster.
When was that?
So it would have been way back, I'm trying to think now, probably in the early 80s, something like that, or late 80s maybe. It'll come to me. Cyclone Vance, I think it was called.
That was after Tracy.
Up in Darwin.
Darwin.
It was the biggest one that had ever hit our coast at the time.
Right.
And it wrecked Exmouth, but we had a lot of houses there and we didn't have any damage. So that, we were very lucky with it and... Also, we had the stuff worked out by then.
Yeah.
So that gave us a big boost and the business went from, you know, sort of doubled overnight after that.
Gets very hot up in Exmouth,
very
doesn't
hot.
It?
Yeah, it does.
Kind of have
super
to
hot.
Work in those conditions.
Well, they don't actually... So the problem is they measure the temperature at Learmonth.
Okay.
Not at Exmouth. And Learmonth's got more of a coastal influence. You'd think Exmouth would have because it's right on the point.
Right.
But it's not, the wind's coming the other way, so the wind's travelled a fair way over land if it's a hot breeze.
Right.
So Learmonth's always better, and that's where that young guy died not that long ago, walking with his father a few years back. And they thought it was only going to be like 40, and they said that day it was nearly 50.
Wow.
And the young kid died with his old man.
Yeah. Yeah.
So it's a really hot place.
Would have made a difference to the working conditions,
Oh, yeah. But when you're young, you don't worry about that sort of thing.
You kind of just get on with
it. And in those days, it was all... Everything I ever did basically after the army was contract or piecework. So we're either working within the business doing our own stuff or working as contractors for other people. So you only got paid for what you did. So if it was a hot day and you decided not to work, we didn't get any money. So
that's right. So
you usually
motivated to work. So with carpentry, were you doing a particular... kind of carpentry? Was it like roof carpentry or was it just generally...
A bit of everything.
So you learned sort of things as fine as furniture making and stuff like that?
Or? Not so much that end of it, more construction.
Mm.
But yeah, you kind of learn as you go along. Like we worked out how to run a steel fabrication shop.
Right.
So carpenters are pretty, particularly if you've been up north, you've got to kind of be able to do whatever gets thrown up. You can't turn around and say, oh, well, I'll go somewhere and get that from somewhere else. There is nowhere else.
No.
You know, it might be a week to find something. So you kind of make do with whatever you had.
Have to make
you quickly
things.
Taught yourself how to weld and
a
little bit about basic mechanics and electrical and all the sorts of stuff you're not allowed to do anymore these days. But so you had to do that because there's no other way to do it. You know, if you didn't do that. And once you got there, you had to work out how to finish the job, because otherwise if you had to come back a second time, well, you didn't make any money, you know, it cost you a fortune.
Do you think things, you know, with all the regulations and things, how everything's funneling people into experts, you know, in certain areas, that something's been lost, or...?
Oh, I think it has, because I think, like, in those days, you just did... And people... Oh, I can remember I went to Warman, it's called now. Is it called Warman? Warman, which was in those days was called Turkey Creek. And we did a house for the Warman community up there for the... I can't remember whether it was for the doctor, but for someone who worked for the community. And we took the house up there. When we got there, the guy that was supposed to supply us all the aggregate to make the concrete, because we used to mix our own concrete for the stumps and everything, he said, oh, I've been flat out and I've forgotten all about it. So he was a local contractor in town that ran the roadhouse. And he said to me, you've got two choices. He said, you can either go out the creek where it was all river wash rock that they used to use, pretty rough concrete, and there's an old loader part out there. He said, but I don't reckon you'll get it going if you don't know what you're doing. Or he said, can you drive a backhoe? I said, yeah. He said, well, can you dig a grave? And I said, yeah, whereabouts? And there was a little cemetery thing just out of the town. He said, out there, he said, I'll take you out and show you. He said, you dig the grave and I'll go and get the thing down and bring the truck back in. Because he said, you probably won't start the truck either. So he came back with a truckload of metal in one. And by then I dug the grave. And the police came with a body in the back of the police wagon.
Oh, okay.
And we buried the gentleman. Someone said a few words and that was it.
Oh.
I thought, imagine doing that today. Yeah. You go up there to deliver a house and wind up burying someone.
That's right. So it was kind of a bit of a trade exchange.
Well, he said, you've got two options. You know. He said, I've got these two jobs I've got to do today.
Yes.
One is for you and one's that. He said, you won't be able to do the one out there, I'm sure. He said, if you can drive a backhoe, well, you can... And the ground was hard as anything. You couldn't dig it with a shovel. You know.
But your explosives...
Yeah. Well, I'd used plant equipment. I knew a little bit about stuff, right. You know. Back in those days, I was probably in my 30s. But, yeah, it was interesting how... You know, in those days, that's what people...
So there's a lot of flexibility in that, isn't there?
You have to be.
Yeah.
I don't think they are like now. You look at... I've got a son now who's working fly in, fly out, you know?
Mm.
And he, in actual fact... He's still in that. Some areas it's still acceptable. Like, he works for a mob that do mobile crushing. So they'll set a crusher up and work for one of the big companies for 6 months or a year. So those guys have to be more hands. So he's an electrician, but he knows all about belts and he's a fitter as well, where they would frown on that in a mine site. You wouldn't have an electrician doing fitting work. You'd have a fitter and then you'd have an electrician and then you'd have something else.
Yeah.
Whereas, and then he'd be driving a loader. He's got to have all the tickets. It's the loader guy's crook. So they're still there, but it's usually in those smaller operations, not the big ones. The big ones are all very clean cut.
That's
the safety
right,
regulations
yeah.
and what you wear and how you do it. And,
yeah.
And a lot of it's just rubbish, you know, that just them covering their backsides without...
Yeah.
There's no less accidents than I think than there ever was, but they want to make sure that it looks like there is people wearing helmets inside cars and all this sort of rubbish, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
I used to say to them, do you wear a helmet when you go to bed?
I think too, you know, there were sometimes regulations around where the unions put certain things in place
to say,
well, this is what that job is and, you know, you're not supposed to do any of this type of thing, you know.
And that was, I mean, we were lucky we missed nearly all of that.
Right.
The only time I ever struck it, I remember we did the wet canteen, which was like the watering hole, at Show Gap.
Yep.
And it was right on the side of the Hall Road. So the Hall Road came down like that and the wet canteen was tucked off to one side. And that was the first job I'd ever met a safety inspector. I didn't even know what one was. And I had these two drainers working for me. We'd sighted all the buildings and we're getting it all ready. We had to do the septic as part of the contract. And we're getting all this. And these two drainers were from the East Alligator River. The Alligator River, I don't know if it's the East Alligator or the Alligator, in the Northern Territory. And they were two of the roughest characters you've ever met. And they'd never worn shoes, ever. So they were used to work in either thongs or bare feet. And this guy came along and nearly died. He was a pom. And he said to me, those blokes haven't got any boots. I said, and they've never worn boots. Have a look at their feet. He said, they can't work here doing that. And in the end, he said to me, I said, well, you have to go and tell the boss that the wet can, they won't be opening because I can't get drainers from, you know, in Shea Gap out of nowhere. This is all the only ones I can get.
Right.
And yeah, in the end, He said, the boss came down and he said, I'll tell him to put boots on and I'll get this guy to go somewhere else. And as soon as he goes, I can take the boots. He said, I said, they can't wear boots, I'll kill them. They'd never worn shoes or anything. So they took their boots off and then back in they got with their crowbars, putting explosives in the holes and it's all rock. And but, you know, you couldn't do that today.
No, no. It's
those sort of people have sort of disappeared, I suppose.
Well, that's right. I think a lot of times, yeah, it was part of the times, wasn't it?
Yeah.
And there is something about self-reliance in that flexibility too, and just the creativity of trying to make things fit and make things work.
Yeah.
And
in those days,
having to get the job done sort of thing.
And that was, you know, when I started, there was no angle fridges or anything like that. So, you know, we used to, all the meals were dry. You know, you had dry meals.
Yeah.
We used to make jaffles out of bread. When the bread got that stale, that if you threw it on the ground, it'd shatter. You'd put it in a jaffle iron and then put your baked beans and all the other stuff inside it, and that'd let that soak for a bit so the jaffle would close there.
Yeah.
And then that's what we used to live off. You know?
I remember the jaffle irons. They were pretty good, weren't they?
We used to have a four-way one. You could cook for four. You cook four at once, you know, a big fire.
Yeah.
And we just used to camp in the trucks or camp on the side of the road or wherever you were.
Okay. So you used to kind of... have a fire and be
just light a fire.
In,
in those days, you could pretty much light it within reason. Light a fire wherever you like,
yeah.
As long as you didn't set fire to anything. And that's how we operate. Because you'd leave Perth, you didn't know where you're going to be that night if you're going up north. So,
has that given you a bit of appreciation for that country?
Oh yeah.
Do you go up there now?
Terrific country. Yeah, my daughter was in Darwin for quite a while, so we used to go to Darwin. We've probably driven up the Darwin probably three or four times now.
Yep.
She's back now. But, I love all that country around, you know, El Questro and all the way through to Wyndham and Derby and all around there. It's a fantastic spot.
Because you can see a lot more of the stars, I guess, at night time as
yeah,
well.
Yeah, oh, yeah, yeah. So yeah, we built a resort at Nalu Station. And I remember we used to go out the back and that had the old generators, obviously. And they used to go off at 10 o'clock. Once the generator's gone off, half an hour after that, once your eyes have got used to them, you could go out and lay on the lawn out there and have a beer and look up at the stars, and you could see all the satellites.
Right.
There are thousands of satellites up there just going over the top all the time, which you can't see in Perth. But you can see the tracks up there because there's no background light whatsoever.
Wow.
Yeah.
And yeah, you can actually see a lot more of of what's out
can't
you?
Can.
I wonder, so with a lot of the remote communities, the Aboriginal people out there would have quite a different view of life to a lot of people in the cities and that sort of thing.
Yeah, totally different. They? Totally, yeah. You wouldn't.
I guess, yeah, did you were you able to sit down with people and have a...
Yes and no. In some communities, they were quite... like, there's a lot of Aboriginal people I've run into up north that actually... very noisy dog.
Yeah.
that actually have jobs just like anyone else, and they travel around as well. Yes. And they may have a community they go back to at certain times of the year or whatever.
Yeah.
But they work the whole year. But there's a lot of people up there that just live in the community. That's their life, you know?
Yeah. There's some of the people... have range of jobs and things like that, or in the tourism industry, and
some of them do. And there's some really remote ones. I mean, you know, you got no idea. Some of them, you know, you go to Beagle Bay and places like that. Wow, there's a long, long way from even.
It's a long way from
even Belga. Belga's quite a big community, you know, but it's in the middle of literally, not like you get, you know, almost into Halls Creek and then drop down 100 odd k's or whatever, and you're into the back of Belga, and that's.
Yeah,
you know,
it's hard for medical care.
Hard for
and
everything.
All of that.
Hard for the police. Hard to.
Yeah.
It's hard for the schools. It's hard to get people to stay there, like as teachers or.
Yeah.
Because it's so remote, there's nothing. Literally.
Mm. Are they dry communities, a lot of those?
Some of them are. I would say now probably the majority are. But I must admit, I haven't been in it for a fair while now. But
long time.
Just from I'm keen to keep in contact with. People, and also I do a fair bit of reading on it, and it would appear to me that probably most don't. Whether they're successfully totally dry, I don't know. But they certainly, that's the rule. They want to try and keep them dry.
Yeah, sort of keep the traditional way of life.
Keep the traditional way of life going rather than...
Yeah. So how do you think things have changed from, you know, when you were kind of originally doing all of that? I mean, we've covered a little bit of that.
The rules and regulations are probably the biggest change.
Yeah.
Because, you know, you could do any... Like, I remember driving a truck from Whitnome. We were doing a job at Cadidry. That was another part of this same camp, which is about, I don't know, I can't remember now. Cadidry is about 80 k's up the road or something. And I used to drive the semi up there, and the cop came to me and he said, I saw you driving that semi yesterday. He said, I don't reckon you've got a licence for that. And I said, oh. He said, you better come and see me tomorrow. So I came and saw him the next day. And he said, we better get your licence, eh? Because otherwise, he said, you'll get into trouble if you have a prank. I said, okay. So he made me drive around with them two or three times in the truck. Made me back it up beside the pub, up the alley, up the side of the pub. And then he said, okay. And then he gave me the licence. Now, you know, could you imagine that these days?
No,
you know.
No. But
so that's how it was. You know, yeah, he knew I had to drive the truck, and he knew that the mine at Cadidry or the camp at Cadidry had to be finished.
Needed. Yeah.
And so there was no point in him, and it was bad for him and the town if stopping it all. So he just used common sense and thought, well.
Driver's licences were like that too, weren't they in the country and all of that type of thing. Where nowadays it's almost like. Kids, they go to get their driver's licence, they have to go fail about half a dozen times before
they can get it.
Yeah.
And it's nothing to do with whether they can drive or not. It's just about... But anyway, that's how it was. And that's probably the biggest change, and the fact that you could do so many things without getting into strife, that things could actually move forward pretty rapidly. Like you could... In those days, you could make a decision if you wanted to build a camp at a certain town, and within a month, you could have it being built. Now they go through planning processes and this process and that process, and then at the end of the day someone doesn't like it, so then they go back and have more consultation or something, and a lot of this stuff was just temporary. It was only going to be there for a year anyway, you know. It wasn't like it was going to be a problem. A year's time it'll be gone. But that was how it was in those days. These days it would be much more difficult.
A lot of delays, which can end up meaning that something doesn't get done at all, or...
And money.
A lot of money spent.
And regulation, like I'm still a builder, registered builder. And it was only probably 8 years ago now, something like that. You had the Builders Registration Board. The Builders Registration Board had about 14 employees, I think. And they had to send out a newsletter twice a year, or maybe four times a year, once a quarter, telling you about what was happening in the trade and whatever. The government took it over, and it's now part of Commerce and... What was Commerce and Trader? It's now called Commerce Mining, and or whatever it's called now.
Yeah.
It's got about 250 employees, and I get an email. It's unusual if I don't get one every second day, telling me about some new regulation or some new change or some new website that I've got to go to and this and that. And that was the difference. That was only over 8 years. So, you know, like even the bushfire regulations, all that stuff now, you know. If you're in a wrong spot now, that's added $70,000, $80,000, $100,000 to the cost of a house. In a lot of cases, it was necessary, but in a lot of cases, it was totally unnecessary, but that's just how it turned out.
You sometimes wonder whether, you know, once a job's created, then there
needs to... It just gets bigger and bigger.
It's almost like it has to be justify itself by creating more regulations.
Yeah. And I always use that as an example. You had 14 people all those years, they ran the whole thing, and nothing much has changed. There's no less builders going broke, or, you know, the houses aren't being built any better. If anything, they're probably being built worse. And so it's not like it's been a fantastic improvement for the trade or the industry. All it is regulated better.
Yeah.
So you have reams and reams of regulation so that everyone's backside's covered, so that if anything goes wrong, they can point the finger and it's not them. That's what it's all about. And the hundreds of people and all of that cost just gets passed down the line to the end consumer and the end, the poor bugger that's trying to buy a house. You know, young kids that are trying to get a house. And
it doesn't seem to have helped in the eastern states with those big high-rise apartments, you know.
Because, again, if you go back, when I first started, Shire Building Inspectors did site inspection. That was their job. So even if you were putting a transportable home in... they'd come and have a look at the footings if he was around at the time, if he could do it. If they knew you and they knew you weren't going to cheat, they probably weren't as fussed about it. But they'd come and have a look at the footings, they'd make sure that was done properly, and then they'd come back and inspect the home when it was finished to make sure that they were happy with it.
So they knew what they were looking for.
Now the councillor will not come, a building inspector will not come anywhere near a site.
Okay.
Never, never. Don't want to touch, don't want to close their eyes. Because they're frightened if they ever went there and said anything, you know. Health inspectors still come and look at certain things. But rarely do you get a building inspector ever come and check anything. They'll tell you, you have to do all of these things, and then it's up to the builder. Well, you know, that's where half this problem. And then the old days with those high rises, you had a clerk of works. And the clerk of works was the NDP, he worked independently for the owner of the building or the architect, depending.
Mm.
He was nothing to do with the building. And then he'd watch the job as it progressed, you know. They cut all of them out.
Yeah, so it kind of.
So now it's a free for all with a heap of regulation that's not enforced.
Yes.
You know, Australian standards for everything you can think of. There's thousands of Australian standards, thousands and thousands.
So the solution would be fewer regulations but more enforcement of the regulations?
Not even enforcement, more people looking at what's going on.
Yes.
Like that are
just
hands
checking.
Off to one side. They're either working, representing the owner or representing. And in the case of local government with building inspectors, they should be representing the Shire, you know, that it's built in, they've given the approval for it. They love having all this regulation for them to sit in their offices and pore over. Well, how about getting out there and making sure that it actually happens, you know?
Yeah, so I guess this is that whole thing of being more hands-on, practical and actually seeing that.
Well, I think the other thing that changed in those days, you would never hear of anyone suing someone. Like, you know, you just didn't hear about it. We wouldn't have even known how to go about it.
No one
would have. Now everyone sues everyone. Well, it's probably nowhere near as bad as we make out, but the general perception is that everyone can
be
sued.
That's the fear.
And that's why I think drives a lot of the stuff with local government is they don't want to be putting themselves or the ratepayers in a position where they're likely to be taken to the cleaners over something. So, you know, WorkSafe would never tell you what to do. We used to have WorkSafe inspections all the time and they'd say, we don't think that's up to scratch. And you'd say, well, what's wrong with it? Oh, well, you'll have to find out. So we'd have to then go and employ another private guy to come in.
Oh, so they wouldn't actually say what it was?
Well, because if they did,
then
and then they were wrong, then the argument was, well, you could have a crack at them. So they'd say, we don't believe that head rig. You know, this is when we, because I was a sawmiller as well. I never went to that bit, but after that we then got involved in timber and sawmilling as well. And we had the old Whittaker's Mill at Greenbushes, we had about 200 employees down there. And they would, you know, when WorkSafe would come along, they'd say, well, we believe the head rig's unsafe. And you'd say, well, what's unsafe about it? Well, you'll have to go and get a safety inspector to come and have a look, we're not happy with it. So they'd force you to do that, and you get another guy, a private guy, a safety engineer or whatever, come along. And he'd say, oh, maybe you should do this or whatever. But he wouldn't know either because it's all in the dark. So he'd say, oh, well, I'll sign off, you know, that you need to do that. And if you do that, I'm happy, I'll sign off that it's safe. So you do it all, and half the time it was just a load of rubbish. But that was how it's become, because people have got that perception, they maybe, if they say something, that someone will take it out of context and sue them or take them to court. And I think that's where the building trade's gone. Like the days of building inspectors going around inspecting us. They don't do that anymore.
So you kind of are you happy you went down this path in your life?
I think I had a great life. I think I was very fortunate. Like old Albert Facio, I had a very fortunate life.
Yeah.
I met some fantastic people. I had some great times. And I always said to my kids, don't ever do a job that you don't like. If you don't like the job, don't do it. Go and get another one. You know, don't leave that one until you get another one either. But make sure that you go and get another one as soon as you can, because you spend too much of your life at work. You don't want to hate it.
It's an important
part
of your life, isn't it? It's a big part.
The most important part, really. Yeah. And so I've always told my kids that. I said, that's what you need to do. And I always practiced it. So I was always lucky. Whatever I did, I really enjoyed, you know.
Yeah.
And I think if you can do that, that's... because that makes life a lot easier, and you'll be a lot more successful at what you do if you're enjoying it. If you're begrudgingly doing it because you don't really want to be there, well, you're never going to be much of a success at it, are you?
No, and it's stressful, isn't it? I think it's always more stress if you don't like it.
So that's what I always say to people, you don't like it?
Yeah.
Don't leave it, go and get another job first, but make sure you do get out as quick as you can.
So the building industry's taken a bit of a hit these days, hasn't it, with the housing and all of that side of things. But
I think my eldest son used to be the sales manager for the when we had the timber company. And when we closed that back in 2013, he went off as a contractor himself. He's a carpenter as well, by trade. And he's still quite busy. So I think if you're good at work, and he's very fussy, one of those real fussy people. That,
yeah.
It'll always take him a bit longer to get the job done, but it'll all be spot on. He drives me nuts, you know.
Yeah.
when I work with him, he's a lot fussier than I am. And so he's always got work. And I think that's part of it. Like, the big sorting outs that happen, it's usually the ones that are only half-baked, that what they did, that they're the first ones to go, you know.
Yeah.
Anyone can get a job when you can't find people, but when it starts to get a bit tighter, people start to get fussier
about who they employ. Yeah.
And that's what I always used to tell our apprentices, you know, like, do the job properly, because at the end of the day, and never upset anyone. Like, there's no need to upset anyone, you know. You should always, even if someone's a bit hard to get on with, still, you still should do your bit, because, you know, they might say something nice about you, which goes to something you never know.
Yeah, it all kind of it gets
one
passed
leads
on,
to another,
doesn't it? Yeah, that's right.
It always does. Boy, has an eye off anyway.
I've really enjoyed listening to Trevor's stories about his life and career in the building trade. Thank you, Trevor, for sharing these, and thank you for listening. Until next time.